During the Grand Age of Exploration, from about the 13th to the 17th centuries, European explorers journeyed throughout the Americas, looking mostly for gold and glory, but also for something less tangible, but equally as mythic, the Fountain of Youth. Spanish conquistadors like Juan Ponce de León navigated the waters of the Caribbean in search for immortality, discovering Florida and journeying to Puerto Rico in the process. They never found it, but that fantasy of postponing death has not subsided. Others still follow them on in this relentless quest.
Our goal for each and every one of our patients, and as I mentioned, we have 43 presently with us in suspension, is to, when the technology is there, to be able to resuscitate and revive them with their personality, memory, and identity intact. Death, as we see it, is not a one precise moment in time.
Dr. Jerry Lemler is the head of ALCOR, the country's largest cryogenics lab in Scottsdale, Arizona. The idea behind cryonics and cryogenics is preserving the body after death, freezing it, with the intention of bringing the body and the person back to life later on. Lemler and the other scientists at ALCOR are experimenting with vitrification, a process that takes the deceased down to 130 degrees below zero, slowing the body's natural processes to a halt without actually freezing the tissue.
In conventional freezing, you need to go all the way down to minus 196 degrees, at which point ice crystals do form, particularly in the brain, which can be extremely damaging for eventual repair scenarios to take care of. What you do get instead, though, is you still get, in effect, the absence of metabolic activity, and particularly for the brain, that's what keeps a person in a suspended animation type state in which molecules just don't move. So that individual, whether they're vitrified or whether they're frozen, is in a metabolic state where it moves at glacial speed. In other words, that person can remain essentially as they are, preserved.
For Lemler, that's what this process is all about. Preserving life, challenging our conceptions of death as the inevitable end by fighting the physical processes that kill our bodies. The body is the starting point and the finishing point here, the vehicle that carries us, so preserving it may be the most direct route. But Lemler believes that his process will not only keep the physical intact, but also the non-physical, memory, identity, personality. He tells the story of a baby girl in Edmonton, Canada, left outside in the cold. She had stopped breathing. Her heart had stopped beating. But she was resuscitated, saved, and brought back to life.
Well, what happened to her soul? Did it depart, you know, when she died and then come back? Is there, you know, again, there's some pretty illogical thinking here. I mean, is there a certain window that the soul can come back, but not, you know, not after you pass a certain number of minutes or hours? My belief clearly is that the soul is essentially the identity of the person, and that resides in the physical and chemical structure that's known as the brain. Preserve the brain, take good care of the brain, stop it from achieving any legitimate metabolic activity, put it to rest, put it to sleep, whatever you want to call it, and then you can rejuvenate it later.
There is certainly something eerie, futuristic, and science fiction-y about cryogenics, and something breathtakingly idealistic about the prospect of resumed human life after death. But there is also something here that speaks to larger human issues. We have been preserving the body from death, preserving and caring for the body after death for thousands of years. The Egyptians, who believed that the body had to be preserved in order to protect the eternal life of the soul, mummified their dead as early as 3000 BC. It is a little creepy.
I know it's people have to get over their initial goriness factor, that we do just preserve the head. We don't have the technology yet to vitrify whole bodies. We do have the technology to vitrify just the head. So I do recommend that you go the neuro option only. That's the way I'm going to go. Additionally, cloning technology is so much closer than reviving and resuscitating patients from cryonic suspension that it's almost a given that from the information contained in the head, that you'll be able, you know, the physicians of the future will be able to grow in a new body for you, and not just the one you had, if that's not what you want, but I'm talking about a young, healthy one.
It's unsettling to hear this. Death is supposed to be the great human equalizer, the one thing you cannot stop. We may lack concrete knowledge about what happens to our souls after death, but maybe what's scarier is what we do know, what happens to our bodies when we die. It's haunting to think about our bodies as casements that death can empty. Well, from Brown Student Radio, 88.1 FM in Providence, it's Inside Out. Each week on our show, we bring you stories of life in Rhode Island, those we know by heart and tales we never get to hear. This week, the rigors of mortis, caring for the bodies of the dead. First, the stories of two women who are part of the Cheva Kadisha Society, which performs the ritual preparations for the body in Orthodox and Conservative Judaism. Then the life of Rhode Island funeral director Mark Russell. And finally, tonight, a selection from Tim O'Brien's novel, The Things They Carried, published in 1990. Stay tuned. Inside Out is next.
We do suspend pets, and I think we've got about 8 or 9 dogs and cats in suspension back there with our members.
It's hard to imagine what happens to loved ones and community members between their death and their funeral. But what if you were the one that washed the body, dressed it in a shroud, and placed it in a coffin? Beverly Schneider and Mindy Seidlin are members of a Jewish burial society who do just that.
White sheets, white walls. Nowadays we die in hospitals with machines in our arms and someone we don't know lying next to us. Death comes and who will carry out your body, who will clean it and dress it and place you in a coffin. Chances are you won't know them, they won't know you, and you will pay for the privilege of being handled by a stranger. This all seems terribly modern and frightening and remote. In the Jewish tradition, practices for dealing with the body after death attempt to counter the antiseptic quality of modern death and dying. Jewish death ritual begins with the Chevra Kadisha, or Holy Society, an age-old group that watches over and prepares the bodies of the community's deceased. Though the practices amongst individual Chevra Kadisha societies vary, they are governed by extensive rules and regulations. The regulations cover everything from what blessings to say during the washing of the body to how to clean the fingernails of the deceased. Caring for the body after death is called Chesed Shel Emet, or true kindness, the highest kindness, as it is a good deed which the recipient can never pay back. But of course, this privilege is a trying one, as participants must intimately confront the bodies that they have known in life.
My mother died when I was a senior in high school, and I come from a family that believes in hiding any truth that exists. So I wasn't even told that she died. They still left me at school and had her body taken away. And I was torn, just absolutely torn, and wondered what my mother was wearing when she was buried. You know, when I'd visit the cemetery, constantly trying to picture what she looked like when she died. My name is Beverly Schneider, and I'm part of the Chevra Kadisha for Anshe Chesed. The Chevra Kadisha, the word is basically a holy community.
My name is Mindy Seidlin. I'm a doctor, I'm an infectious diseases specialist. I'm a participant in the Chevra Kadisha. An important principle in the whole, all the issues around preparing the body is modesty. Because of this, men's bodies are taken care of by men, women's bodies are taken care of by women. In Orthodox life, women have not very much decisional authority in religious issues. But in this particular circumstance, the women who are taking care of any particular body have to make decisions. The vast majority of decisions get made right there in the room where you're taking care and preparing the body. And I saw this as an area in which, even in Orthodoxy, women are empowered. The body is God's image, after all, so one must treat it with respect. The object when we do the purification is to have it be done respectfully, swiftly, smoothly. So we start by making sure we have on hand all the different shrouds, all the different things we need for washing the body and for doing the ritual purification. The other purpose of this is to minimize any conversation during the ritual purification. Since this is supposed to be respectful to the dead person, we don't talk about anything else. So first the hospital gown, et cetera, are removed. We then take a quick survey to see if there are any appliances, catheters, tubes, whatever, that are remaining that are going to need to be removed and make decisions about what we're going to do with those. After that, the body is cleaned just with water and clean cloths, starting with the head and then the right side of the body and then the left side of the body. What we always do is have the body covered with a clean sheet, so the body is never completely exposed. That would be immodest.
There's a lot of moving around of the body, sort of pulling it back, you know, towards you so the back can be washed. And I'm fairly strong, so one of the roles that I take is, you know, moving the body and holding the body. And your body's up against, you know, in real very intimately with somebody that you know. And it's, to me, those moments still are incredibly intimate and, oddly enough, alive. And just the sense of that closeness, it's almost a caress with the dead.
Jewish funerary practice attempts to treat all people equally so that people are not dressed in their own clothing, they're dressed in traditional linen shrouds and so on. Occasionally, the funeral directors will try to push people toward more expensive types of funeral commodities, and we try to protect them from that. In the United States, a plain pine coffin, which has no metal in it, is used. In Israel, actually, no coffin is used. People are buried in a winding sheet, and that it's simple, that it's not ornate, and there's no difference between rich and poor when they're buried.
Nothing is done unnaturally to the body. It's supposed to start decaying in its natural way. It's not embalmed. It's not made beautiful. So, in part, the deceased doesn't look good. So Jews tend not to have open coffins.
If a person is dying suddenly in a hospital, there's a great deal of activity that happens. And then when the person has died and it's obvious that nothing more can be done from a medical standpoint, suddenly all that activity ceases. And on some level, it's like the person is abandoned. And in some ways, the Jewish ritual is the opposite. It's very complementary. Once the life-saving activities have ceased, the respect for that person continues.
One story comes to mind at this death of our friend, and we were at the funeral, and she has many grandchildren, and one of the youngest was there, and looking into the grave, and somebody wondered, what does she understand? Like, does she understand that our friend was in the coffin? And I looked at my friend who was saying this, and I said, well, what do we understand? Do you really believe that she's in there? And I'm saying to myself, I know she's in there because I put her in there, and I don't believe she's in there. And I've now had like real, you know, visceral experience with dead bodies, and I still don't know it in any way that I would like to say, oh yeah, I know death. What I understand is you never understand.
Mark Russell's family has owned the Monahan Kelly Drabble Sherman Funeral Home for three generations. But becoming a funeral director wasn't Russell's chosen career path. Nearly 30 years ago, when his father suffered from a sudden illness, Russell decided against law school and joined the trade. Up next, producer Molly Messick asks what it's like to have death as the family business.
These are a few facts I picked up in talking with Mark Russell. He performs an average of 180 funerals each year, at a cost of roughly $6,200 apiece, including church, cemetery, and newspaper fees. Cremation is on the rise, so much so that funeral homes now have rental caskets to accommodate families who want to have a viewing, but not full-body burial. In Maine and Vermont, where it's often too cold to dig graves in the winter, there are huge holding tombs where bodies are kept until the spring thaw. In the last 3 years, Mark Russell performed the funerals of both his mother and father, a decision that he explains by saying that he just didn't want someone else to screw them up.
I didn't grow up in the funeral home. We always maintained a separate residence. which is not the case with many, many funeral homes. They actually live and the families are raised right in the building. So their experience is, you know, much closer than mine. You know, I mean, I really had a separate life. Also, from the time I was old enough to do stuff, I helped set up flowers. And when I was 16, I started driving the hearse. So it's not that big of a mystery to you. I guess that's what it really is to people. It's a mystery. You know, and people are afraid of the unknown, and that's why they're afraid of death and afraid of funeral homes, because it just represents about the biggest unknown there is. And I didn't have that fear because it wasn't an unknown. You know, my daughter, my oldest one, when she was 3 years old, she'd pull a chair over next to the casket and stand on it and hold the picture and tell the hairdresser what to do with the hair and the makeup, you know. Jennifer would hold the picture, so. You know, I mean, we don't live in the building, but they come around here. And the little one came here one day, and she ran up the ramp and into that front room there, and we had this lady laid out in the casket. She climbed up on the kneeling bench and looked at her. Said, "Gee, Dad, she looks good." I said, "Well, thank you. You know, critiquing my work, and they like it." And then about a week later, she was back to the funeral home here, and she ran up and ran into the room looking for the lady. And she said, "Well, where is she?" And I said, "Well, I buried her." And the daughter looked at me. She said, "Well, why? She looks so good."
Mark Russell's funeral home is located on the corner of Waterman and Wayland Streets in Providence, Rhode Island. It is a large, rambling building with white siding, and inside it is comfortably quiet. The floor is thickly carpeted, the walls papered in a striped pattern that is stately but not austere. It is almost cozy. Russell's great-grandfather started the funeral home in 1876, and Russell himself has racked up 27 years in this line of work. He is friendly and matter-of-fact, and smiles frequently. But this, to him, is business.
Truly, you know, if I say to a colleague that I had a good funeral, I would be reflecting the dollars. I mean, we buried Senator Chafee, you know, President Clinton was here and everything else. That was a great funeral, but not financially. I mean, that was just a great one to be part of. But usually, I mean, you know, if you got two funerals directors talking about a great funeral, it's got something to do with the fact that they bought a very good casket and just spent a lot of money. But we do a lot of work for nothing. Or next to nothing. I mean, you know, we would never send a bill out for a child that died. The father that dropped dead last week with two children and a pregnant wife, I basically did it for nothing, and I told his wife to put it in the education of their kids. So, yeah, you know, I mean, that comes into play. But you can't take every death home. If you do, you don't belong in this business. But if you become too callous, then you're a lousy funeral director because, you know, it may be business to us. You know, everybody's mother only dies once. Everybody's father only dies once. And if you treat it carelessly, you won't do any business because that'll haunt you.
In high school, I carpooled with the local funeral director's daughter. Her brother was attending mortuary school at the time, and in what seemed to be a remarkably convenient arrangement, was engaged to a cosmetologist. One of their family vehicles that came to pick us up many afternoons after school was a large black Suburban. I would sit in the rear passenger side seat, and the seat next to me would often be folded down to accommodate what, though draped in heavy black cloth, could have been understood as nothing other than a human body, en route to be prepared for its proverbial final journey. I spent many of these car trips trying to keep myself from supposing the gender and imagining the facial features of the figure parked solidly beside me, appraising the skyward-pointed feet, the gentle rise of the stomach, and the round lump of the head of the recently departed.
People avoid you when you have a death because they don't know what to say. The one person that'll talk to you is the undertaker. So you cover a lot of bases. You're not just a funeral director, you're the friend, you're the surrogate clergy. You're the one that they can talk to because at that point, you know, their friends are, they see you coming, they'll kind of go the other way because they don't know what to say. And I just, you know, explain to people that I'm only going to make a horrible situation a little less horrible. You know, if I do that, then I've done my job. You know, I can't fix it. I can't make them undead. Usually we send them out of here, you know, feeling good about the whole process. That means we've done a decent job, but we can't fix it. Yeah, I've been to someone's house in the middle of the night where someone died, and they had set the table for breakfast, and you know, three sisters lived together, and you know, one of them died in the middle of the night. Now they had the three, cereal bowls set at the table. They didn't know what to do, so after I got the body out, I sat in her place and ate her cereal. That way, her bowl wouldn't have gone empty. You know, whatever they need, I'll sit there. I'm in no hurry. You know, I don't have any little magic thing that I do when things get down. So just kind of work your way through it. I don't know, I mean, you just gotta fight it off. There's nothing special, you know. Just, I pretty much just, you know, just keep it in. I don't know, I just kind of work it out myself. There's nothing special, though, you know. Go home and have a couple of scotches or something. Hug your kids.
Before we leave, Russell shows us the caskets. A two-room display area lit with soft lights in which 10 assorted boxes sit open at waist level, small placards laying inside, naming the price. The most popular model is simple, clean lines and dark wood, and I think it is probably the one I would choose myself, were I put in the position. Black-clad mourners are filing in as we pack up recording equipment and shrug on coats, and we try to make a discreet exit through the back door. A woman, middle-aged, is seated, sobbing, head in hands, and a younger man kneels at her side, his hand on her shoulder. He looks at us briefly. The casket is open, and the dark-haired head of a man rests on the pillow. It is, appropriately, a rainy afternoon.
Welcome back to Inside Out. This week on our show, The Rigors of Mortis, Caring for the Body After Death. Our last story, read by Chris Muller, is an excerpt from Tim O'Brien's novel, The Things They Carried.
His jaw was in his throat. His upper lip and teeth were gone. His one eye was shut. His other eye was a star-shaped hole. His eyebrows were thin and arched like a woman's. His nose was undamaged. There was a slight tear at the lobe of one ear. His clean black hair was swept upward into a cowlick at the rear of the skull. His forehead was lightly freckled. His fingernails were clean. The skin on his left cheek was peeled back in three ragged strips. His right cheek was smooth and hairless. There was a butterfly on his chin. His neck was open to the spinal cord, and the blood there was thick and shiny, and it was this wound that had killed him. He lay face up in the center of the trail, a slim, dead, almost dainty young man. He had bony legs, a narrow waist, long, shapely fingers. His chest was sunken and poorly muscled, a scholar, maybe. His wrists were the wrists of a child. His rubber sandals had been blown off. One lay beside him, the other a few meters up the trail. He had been born, maybe, in 1946, in the village of Mai Kai, near the central coastline of Quang Nai Province, where his parents farmed, and where his family had lived for several centuries, and where, during the time of the French, his father and two uncles and many neighbors had joined in the struggle for independence. He was not a communist. He was a citizen and a soldier. In the village of Mai Kai, as in all of Quang Nai, patriotic resistance had the force of tradition, which was partly the force of legend, and from his earliest boyhood, the man I killed would have listened to stories about the heroic Trung sisters and the Tran Hung Dao's famous rout of the Mongols and Lei Loi's final victory against the Chinese at Tat Dong. "Oh man, you trashed the bastard," Azar said. "You scrambled his sorry self. Look at that, you did. You laid him out like shredded wheat." "Go away," Kyo said. "I'm just saying the truth, like oatmeal." "Go," Kyo said. "Okay then, I take it back," Azar said. He started to move away and then stopped and said, "Rice Krispies, you know? On the dead test, this particular individual gets A+. Kyo glanced at the body. "All right, let me ask you a question," he said. "You want to trade places with him? Turn it all upside down. You want that? I mean, be honest." The upper lip and gum and teeth were gone. The man's head was cocked at the wrong angle, as if loose at the neck, and the neck was wet with blood. "Think it over," Kyo said. Then later he said, "Tim, it's a war. The guy wasn't Heidi, he had a weapon, right? It's a tough thing for sure, but you gotta cut out that staring." The butterfly was making its way along the young man's forehead, which was spotted with dark freckles. The nose was undamaged. The skin on the right cheek was smooth and fine-grained and hairless. Frail-looking, delicately boned, the young man would not have wanted to be a soldier, and in his heart would have feared performing badly in battle. Even as a young boy growing up in the village of Mai Kai, He had often worried about this. He imagined covering his head and lying in a deep hole and closing his eyes and not moving until the war was over. He had no stomach for violence. He loved mathematics. The young man would not make himself fight them. He often wanted to, but he was afraid, and this increased his shame. If he could not fight little boys, he thought, how could he ever become a soldier and fight the Americans with their airplanes and helicopters and bombs? It did not seem possible. In the presence of his father and uncles, he pretended to look forward to doing his patriotic duty, which was also a privilege. But at night he prayed with his mother that the war might end soon. Beyond anything else, he was afraid of disgracing himself, and therefore his family and village. But all he could do, he thought, was wait and pray and try not to grow up too fast. Along the trail there were small blue flowers, shaped like bells. The young man's head was wrenched sideways, not quite facing the flowers, and even in the shade a single blade of sunlight sparkled against the buckle of his ammunition belt. The left cheek was peeled back in three ragged strips. The young man's fingernails were clean. There was a slight tear at the lobe of one ear, a sprinkling of blood on the forearm. He wore a gold ring on the third finger of his right hand. His chest was sunken and poorly muscled, a scholar maybe. His life was now a constellation of possibilities. So yes, maybe a scholar. And for years, despite his family's poverty, the man I killed would have been determined to continue his education in mathematics. The means for this were arranged, perhaps, through village liberation cadres, and in 1964 the young man began attending classes at the university in Saigon, where he avoided politics and paid attention to the problems of calculus. He devoted himself to his studies. He spent nights alone, wrote romantic poems in his journal, took pleasure in the grace and beauty of differential equations. The war, he knew, would finally take him, but for the time being he would not let himself think about it. He had stopped praying. Instead now he waited. And as he waited, in his final year at the university, he fell in love with a classmate, a girl of 17, who one day told him that his wrists were like the wrists of a child, so small and delicate, and who admired his narrow waist and the cowlick that rose up like a bird's tail at the back of his neck. She liked his quiet manner. She laughed at his freckles and bony legs. The body lay almost entirely in shade. There were gnats at the mouth, little flecks of pollen drifting above the nose. The butterfly was gone. The bleeding had stopped except for the neck wounds. Kiowa picked up the rubber sandals, clapping off the dirt, then bent down to search the body. He found a pouch of rice, a comb, a fingernail clipper, a few soiled piasters, a snapshot of a young woman standing in front of a parked motorcycle. Then he squatted down. "I'll tell you the straight truth," he said. "The guy was dead the second he stepped on the trail. Understand me? We all had him zeroed." "We all had him zeroed. A good kill. Weapon, ammunition, everything." Tiny beads of sweat glistened at Kiowa's forehead. His eyes moved from the sky to the dead man's body to the knuckles of his own hands. "So listen, you best pull yourself together. Can't just sit here all day." Later he said, "Understand?" Then he said, "5 minutes, Tim. 5 more minutes and we're moving out." The one eye did a funny twinkling trick, red to yellow. His head was wrenched sideways as if loose at the neck, and the dead young man seemed to be staring at some distant object beyond the bell-shaped flowers along the trail. The blood at the neck had gone to a deep purplish black. Clean fingernails, clean hair. He had been a soldier for only one day. After his years at the university, the man I killed returned with his new wife to the village of Maike, where he was enlisted as a common rifleman with the 48th Viet Cong Battalion. He knew he would die quickly. He knew he would see a flash of light. He knew he would fall dead and wake up in the stories of his village and people. Kiowa covered the body with a poncho. "Hey, you're looking better," he said. "No doubt about it. All you needed was time, some mental R&R. Then he said, "Man, I'm sorry." Then later he said, "Why not talk about it?" Then he said, "Come on, man, talk." He was a slim, dead, almost dainty young man of about 20. He lay with one leg bent beneath him, his jaw in his throat, his face neither expressive nor inexpressive. One eye was shut, the other was a star-shaped hole. "Talk," Kiowa said.
Inside Out is a production of Brown Student Radio. The executive producer is Paul McCarthy. Narration is done by Nathan James, and original music tonight by Chris Bell. Contributors to this week's show include Casey Theringer, Danielle Posen, Alana Berkowitz, Molly Messick, Leanne Haig, Anna Goldman, and Robin Amer. Special thanks to Chris Muller, Ari Johnson, Bart Green, Beth Taylor, and Howard Berkowitz. Funding for Inside Out is made possible by a generous grant from the Casey Shearer Memorial Fund. You can hear this show and all of our past episodes on our website. The address is www.bsrlive.com/insideout. While you're there, let us know what you think of the show by dropping us an email to insideout@brown.edu. Tune in 2 weeks, Thursday at 7:30, for more stories of life in Rhode Island on Inside Out.
Please don't bury me down in the cold ground. No, I'm gonna have them cut me up and pass me all around. Throw my brain in a hurricane and the blind can have my eyes. Death can take both of my ears if they don't mind the sound. Give my stomach to Milwaukee if they run out of beer. Put my socks in a seat.